You're on 121.5, the emergency frequency.
Welcome to the 21.5 Show, a podcast for professional pilots by professional pilots. Join Dylan and Max, both with experience in flight instruction, the airlines, and business aviation, as they talk to a variety of industry experts, share stories, and have a little fun along the way.
Do you hear that, ladies and gentlemen? It's the sound of the dark side of the force coming through the microphone. Max is fully consumed. Give in to your feelings.
Yeah.
It is your destiny.
I'm up to my neck.
Well, we're doing a little remote recording today because you're back at 121, back at the schoolhouse.
That's right.
Through these doors.
Level 4 requalification has commenced.
How's it gone so far?
That's good. You know, it's back in the saddle. The light bulbs are turning on, remembering how things are done, what callouts are to be made.
So 737, is it coming back
the
to multiple, you?
The very extensive flap settings that are normally featured on Boeing aircraft.
I never got that, why there's like 100, but it was always seemed
maximum
fun for the
flexibility.
Guy. Yeah, I guess. It seemed fun for the guy moving it because it's like, you can make these cool like little moves because you know how it like triggers with the spring.
There's like gates in there. It's funny. That's another thing you have to get used to because you can end up calling for a flap set and the guy's over there like, you know, you hear clicking and whacking around with the flap handle. It's pretty funny.
It's the perfect analogy of the difference between Boeing and Airbus. Like all you need to do is show the like flap 1, 2, 3, 4 of an Airbus. And then the massive handle on it in
the
a 737.
1, 2, 5, 10, 15, 25, 30, and 40.
It's so with the good. Gates and everything else. Yeah,
it's funny.
So, all right. Well,
anyway, yeah, back at it. It's interesting how the training is designed for people that have been gone for, say, a year and a half-ish.
Oh, so they are actually like kind of tailoring
this is tailored for this. And so essentially, we talked about AQP, right? And it's kind of interesting when you take a step back. So when you come to initial, you start, that's where you start, right? And then your training progresses year over year with AQP and what focus items they have and yada, yada, right? Well, when you're gone for over a year, so 2 years out, you have to start over at square one.
Okay.
So we're 3/4 of the way there. So they had to design a program that basically incorporates what was missed in 2020, right? Because we weren't here for 2020 recurrent, essentially. And then also incorporates stuff in 2021 recurrent and requal, and also takes a bunch of people that were out for a year and a half, and some people did nothing. I mean, like literally just hung out. Some people got other jobs doing something other than flying airplanes. And some people were flying airplanes, a lot of people were in the military, ramped up their reserve flying or whatever, or in the guard, or they, you know, had some other civilian flying job like I did. And so you have to design a training program that encompasses all of that stuff and is tailored for all of those different set of circumstances.
Okay.
It's pretty interesting. It's pretty interesting. And like I'm training with a guy that was out, he had a job in aviation, but was not flying airplanes. So he's rustier than I am because I've been flying airplanes, but sometimes it's worse because all he remembers last was flying here. And I was a corporate guy and I, you know, slacking on my call outs and flying a different airplane that's fresh in my mind. So I'm battling with that and doing stuff, you know, that with the wrong airplane or things like that. So it's interesting how they just kind of mash everyone together, but the training is designed really well. It ends up working out really well. And sometimes you're like scratching your head and like, what are we doing? And then when it's over, you're like, yeah, I guess that made sense. This is working out. So anyway, they got to figure it out. I will say that like it's working.
Okay. And I mean the call outs, that's one of those things. Is it like, does it come right back to you or?
I'd say 85% of it does.
Have you been using any non-standard call outs like,
don't flaps. They ain't 20s, they 10s, but we keep them clean, though.
No.
I've kept those reserved for the corporate flying.
Okay.
The 90.
Yeah, that's probably better.
But it's interesting. A lot of people that have never flown in the airlines don't realize, like, the call is when you're pilot flying, for example, is landing gear up. And the pilot not flying says, positive rate, landing gear up. It's not gear up. It's landing gear up. And if you don't say landing gear up, and the other guy doesn't say, or gal says gear up, it's landing gear up. Like, it's a very specific set of verbiage that you have to stick to. And everyone at the airlines probably realize that, but that's like the sim instructor will correct you, be like, no. Landing gear up. You're like, oh, sorry. Landing gear up.
And then one thing I've noticed in business aviation too, a lot of people will make a call out and then the other guy will say thank you, or there's some other extra
or please.
Response. Like,
no, please. Flaps like, five, please. The, yeah. No, it's just flaps five.
Yeah. There's none of that. So I think it's good. It's good to get back and refresh. I think the tightening up, that's important. That's a good challenge for everybody.
It's funny because one of our the big focuses this year is something called drift.
Oh.
Where you get a little bit away from the standard, like saying gear up instead of landing gear up, or your call through 10,000 feet saying through 10 instead of saying 10,000 feet. And when it starts there, then you accept deviations and then it goes further than that. And essentially, if you look at the Challenger accident of 1986, we watched a video and they kind of related it to that. And you're like, huh, there's something to this.
That's the normalization of deviance.
Yeah, that's
great
it.
Band name.
Exactly. So anyway, overall, it's going well. PCs in a few days.
Good.
All will be good.
Well, welcome back. We miss you at the hangar. But
thank you.
Life goes on. Big show today. Well, I think this episode is going to be really interesting for folks because in the past, it kind of ties into the decision you made and where you're at now. And you're at the airlines and you talked about, man, I wish I could combine some elements of corporate and business aviation with some elements of the airlines. And so we had a listener write in from Flexjet, one of the head of training there, Jim Dunn. And he said, guys, there is something that's like between corporate and the airlines and it's fractional flying. And that's one hole in both of our resumes that one box we never checked. So that conversation with Jim is coming up later in the episode. And I think it's fascinating because it really opened my eyes to a lot of opportunities and maybe things that are available to folks that maybe don't want to go the 121
route. Yeah, a lot of unknown things came to surface that neither of us had any idea about, which is always really cool. That's the whole point of this show, I suppose, for everybody.
That's right. But before we do that, we've got our regular segments. We've got to attack first reviews. We got one more review. You want to read this one?
The premier podcast for any pro pilot.
Dun, 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 dun.
This was written by assistant regional pilot. You get that reference, right?
Yes, okay. I do.
Assistant to the regional manager. I've been listening to Max and Dylan since the start of the pandemic, and they have helped me guide my aviation career to where I want it to be. Their show is quality interviews. They are pretty hilarious, and I usually end up purchasing whatever they promote because I didn't know I needed it until they told me about it.
Such as the 21.5 can cooler, which we have one left of. It's the middle of winter. I mean, you need a can cooler right now.
The timing might have been a little late on that one.
Yeah, a little questionable on that one. $60. I got one left. I'm trying to. I'll even do it for $59 if you do a $59 US donation. 21.5podcast.com. Scroll to the bottom of the page for the donate link. We'd like to get that one out by Christmas so we can make our next Tumblr order back from Yeti. So thanks for the review, assistant regional pilot. Shoot us an email and I'll send you some stickers. I owe a lot of people some stickers right now. I'm going to do a big sticker bomb mailing here this week. Lots in the mailbag, Max, which is, of course, brought to you by our friends at Advanced Air Crew Academy. You signed up for some courses recently, I think.
I did. I had them send us a couple of interesting courses, and I'm a little inundated with online courses as my iPad is up here, you know, with all this stuff. But I do intend on checking those out, as I'm hoping you are also. And then we are going to have a really interesting segment based on some of those courses coming up in the future, so Advanced Air Crew Academy can demonstrate their mastery of aviation knowledge
and their ease of use. If, you know, if you're a corporate flight department manager, you need to educate the troops. What a great way to do it. Sign on, check out all the courses they offer at aircrewacademy.com. On to the mailbag here. This is a good one. Now, we've talked about this before. It says, hello, I've been listening to your podcast for a while now, and I figured I would pass a suggestion to you guys. How about a podcast centralized around airline basics from a spouse slash significant other point of view? I'm trying to sell my wife on making the jump from military aviation to the airlines, and I think it would be great to hear the good, bad, ugly from their point of view to set expectations. How does it change from the regionals majors? How does it change with seniority? Just some help setting expectations and understanding the basics from that point of view could be interesting. And that's from Kevin.
I think we have a lot to say on that subject.
Yeah.
And I know my wife does.
Yeah.
Literally, when we just signed on to this remote platform that we use to record when we're not together, she was on. Did you hear that? Her on speakerphone? Because yes. I told her, I'm like, you know, you might be able to contribute to this episode we're going to put together. And she's like, you know what? I understand why. She goes, no, she said, today is a slap in the face of why wives or significant others can be frustrated when they're husband or wife is out of town at work, and she's like, you know, the trash and this and that. And I was like,
pull that thing back, let it do what it do, baby.
You just gotta let it do what it do.
Let it do what it do. That's what I told her, and I said, I gotta go. You're gonna do what it do.
Yeah, absolutely. We've been plotting wanting to do this episode for a while, and kind of our vision for this episode would basically be a standalone show that would be a great introduction that you could play to a spouse or a significant other, like a, hey, you know, you start dating someone and you're already in the business, be like, hey, you should listen to this, or you know, if you're trying to make some long-term decisions. So my wife, I think, would be good perspective because I've done regionals, charter, and corporate, so we can get some perspective from her. But here's what I need our listeners to help us out with. I don't think in our network we have a good resource of a spouse that was a military spouse, and then now their spouse is an airline pilot. So I'd like to, if you are in that situation or think you can provide some insight, for shoot us an email, info@215podcast.com, because we'd like to add you to the discussion.
Or anybody else that just has good or unique perspective on this whole quandary of the good, the bad, and the ugly. Right.
But I think it's a great time. I mean, how nice would it be if you're younger and in aviation, you start dating someone seriously or something, and you could be like, hey, listen to this episode. This will kind of explain some things for you. You know,
well, yeah. And we've gotten multiple questions from listeners that are at the regionals or things like that, that are kind of in the beginning stages of their career trying to figure out. Because really, you don't really know until you've experienced it.
So great suggestion, Kevin. We agree with you that that would be a great topic. So we'd love to compile a few resources so we can hit all the different angles. We'll move on with that. Okay. You want to do the next email?
Gentlemen, I was wondering if anyone like the FAA will question the Part 91 operation of an MD-87 that overran the runway at Houston Executive Airport in Texas on October 20th and burned. Thankfully, there were no serious injuries among the 21 occupants. However, you ran a segment some time ago on airplane companies in which the aircraft owner forms a holding organization, in this case, 987 Investments. Operates it under 14 CFR Part 91 of the regulations, although the company received payments and reimbursements from an overreaching organization, also known as the Flight Department Trap, and we did a great episode on that in the past. You can look it up. With
episode 45 with John Clark.
With John Clark, an attorney. It was one of our most popular episodes, believe it or not.
Yep.
He continues here and says, the FAA has questioned this in the past. The issue came on their radar after the Challenger 600 accident at Teterboro Airport in February 2005 about whether such operations might be commercial in nature. In this case, probably under Part 125. I'd be interested in your comments. Best regards, retired and still listening. Mike Steffen.
Good email, Mike. I wish I had more information on the operating structure of this particular entity. I don't have any specific comments on that. Did you see the AvWeb just published the article on what they believe was the cause there, the elevator jam?
Jammed elevator, which is
a problem in
been a problem fleet. In the past. Yeah. Because I guess I don't know a lot about the MD-80. I've never flown one, but I'm pretty sure the elevator is able to free float and it uses tabs to command movement, right?
I was just going to say, do you remember ever taxiing behind them?
Yeah, and then one was up and one was down.
One's up and one's down and you're looking at like, what? And then they just like randomly start moving and you're like, what? And more than once on frequency, I would hear people be like, hey, you know, American, check your stab. They're split. And it's really weird to see if you've never seen it before. But, you know, in the case in this article, they point out the airplane had sat for 11 months before flying. And then they put, you know, 23 passengers on the plane for the first flight. There's going to be a lot of red flags. So getting back to the emailer's question, Mike, yeah, my guess is there's going to be some serious investigation
into
the operation of this, but
I think what he's saying
there's
is
there's a lot of red flags.
It's not really passing the sniff test. Just looking, like we've said, if you guys didn't listen to that episode, one of the big red flags is if it's like something air or November so-and-so LLC or something that obviously is purely for aviation.
Yep.
And that company only exists to promote the operation of aircraft, then the FAA has taken the stance that it's can be considered a commercial operation, and therefore you have to jump through some hoops to make everything good.
Yeah. Lots of
good point, Mike. Yeah. We'll continue to follow this
keep monitoring that. Yeah.
Yeah, we get more info.
Last email. Hey guys, you wondered how many people listen to the podcast at some multiple of normal speed. How many emails have we gotten about the speed thing?
So many. Totally off the radar.
I am one of them, and I can tell you that every aviation podcast I listen to is at least at 1.25, if not 1.5 or 2 times speed. Aviation podcasts are the only podcast where this is necessary. I don't know what it is about aviation podcasters, but none of them talk at anything approaching a normal conversational pace. It's the listening equivalent of taxiing behind SkyWest.
I never thought of SkyWest as being a slow taxier.
I don't know.
That's an American thing, right?
You're back in the airline game now, so I guess you'll have to report back on that. I don't remember them going slow either, but you know, it's probably younger pilots are trying to build their time so they can go on to the majors. So I get it. You know, it's blocker better. all that's to say, it's nothing personal. It seems to afflict the entire aviation podcast world and that world only. Still love the show and look forward to each new episode when it drops. Leisurely, Andrew in Michigan. For mild entertainment, try listening to a favorite. It says PS. For mild entertainment, try listening to a favorite podcast at half speed. They'll sound absolutely toasted and it's delightful.
So I feel like we talk at a normal pace.
I don't know what to say, Andrew. We're doing our best. Here's a funny thing. I don't know if this ever happens to you, but I listen to podcasts a lot in the bathroom, like in the shower. And my Apple, because I have a cool Sonos speaker in there so you can hear them. I don't know, and just take a shower and listen to something.
All right.
And what's funny is if I'm wearing my Apple Watch in the shower, I couldn't figure this out for a long time, but my podcast would always slow down or speed up and do this, like go to half speed or 2x speed. I'm like, how is this happening? What's going on? And the water from the shower was hitting my Apple Watch and it would always hit the button. Apparently on your watch, it has the speed button on it. So I could never figure this out, but I'd get stuck in the shower listening to my podcast at like 2x speed and I couldn't hear anything. I'm like, but I'm
pretty sure the only other person that has probably experienced this problem is Roy. You and him seem like the only people I know that listen to a podcast in the shower. And I listen to a lot of podcasts, but it's never occurred to me to do it while bathing.
Yeah.
So
meanwhile, everyone at FlexJet that's listening to this podcast, waiting for their interviews, shut the show off.
They just turned their head sideways, looked at and like, what is this?
Great. What are we doing? All right. On to flight advice brought to you by our friends at Harvey Watt. the largest provider. Every time I screw it up. Harvey Watt, the largest provider of loss of medical insurance for professional pilots. You know, they send that newsletter out once a month, that free newsletter is kind of like a health update for pilots. They had an interesting thing. The first thing on the newsletter this month was men getting hurt. Based on emergency room statistics, here are the 10 most common ways men hurt themselves. Have you seen this?
No.
Number one's pretty obvious, but it's, you know, it's manly. It's power tools. There were a couple that, like, in, you know, being on a ladder was number two. Using a lawnmower was number three. Okay, pretty good. You know, in the garden, shovels. Here's one that I liked, though. Number seven was cutting firewood. I don't know how many dudes are cutting firewood still, but I guess a lot.
You live in Arizona, bro.
Yeah. And then here's the best one, though. You know, they're all pretty manly, except for number eight and number 10. Number eight is doing laundry, which I don't even know how that's possible. And number 10 is ironing clothes. So,
yeah,
I would say just, you know, show this list to your significant other and be like, I'm doing this for us.
We out there. We doing it.
Yeah, we're doing it. I'm going to avoid doing these things because, you know, I got to protect my medical certificate.
For safety.
This is important. Yeah, this is a safety thing. Well, the flight advice today is pretty serious, Max. And it was submitted via the website on the anonymous form that we have there, 215podcast.com. And you can just go click on the flight advice and shoot it over. it says, I need a bit of professional advice. The co-captain I am with at my company has a bad drinking problem. Doesn't drink and fly, so it's nothing like that. It's just after hours it gets bad. The other night, a bunch of us from the company went out on a day off at home base. The pilot in question got absolutely hammered and acted like a jackass to coworkers, but I don't think he even remembers doing it. Another captain at the company had a talk with him the next day and made him apologize to the coworkers. But I'm a new pilot at a small 135 operator, and we don't have a lot of infrastructure like pro standards or HIMSS. How do you recommend I handle this, since it's not technically a work issue at this time, but we are a pretty tight group of friends at a small operator?
This is a tough one.
Yeah, this is. And I want to address this knowing what the industry is like. Especially when you're young and you don't have a lot of experience and you're at a small shop. It's so totally different at the airlines.
Let's start here. He just referenced pro standards or him. So pro standards, for those of you who don't know, is a thing. It's usually administered through the union. It's basically peers monitoring peers. So meaning we kind of take care of it ourselves before it escalates into a company situation. So if there's a problem with another pilot doing something, you can approach pro standards, the union approaches the pilot and kind of works it out amongst ourselves. So we can all keep each other in line and out of trouble. Would you say, is that pretty good explanation of that? HIMSS is another, if you're an alcoholic kind of program where you have to admit you have a problem and you go into treatment. That's kind of a whole nother deal. That's more of, you don't report somebody generally to HIMSS. They self-report.
That's where they go to get
the
help.
Basis
yeah.
Of the, yeah. And then great program and saved a lot of people's careers. But obviously a small 135 operator doesn't have those kind of things. So what are your thoughts?
I feel like, especially as a young pilot with not a lot of experience, maybe not a lot of pull at the company, this is a really pivotal thing because you kind of want to get along and make sure everyone's happy and not make waves. But this has the potential to drag you down into a situation where, you know, the email says this doesn't happen on the road when you're flying, but you don't really know that.
Yeah, and this is the first step in that direction, though, right?
And I think many of us have known a person like this that, you know, they're probably an alcoholic and there are, you know, a chemical reaction in their body. I'm not a doctor or anything, but like it affects people. Alcohol affects certain people differently. I think we've all seen people that, man, a couple drinks in and they're just a completely different person. So my concern here is that if you let this, if you have to continue to associate with this person, eventually, if you say nothing, set aside what's happening to them, it's also going to affect you probably at some point down the road, and could be a career killer, really. So I think you really have to take this seriously.
Well, not necessarily. I think it's going to put him into a position to make an even more difficult decision. Fortunately, this person seems to be their head's in the right place, and they're trying to think about cutting this off the head. But I think if push came to shove, it seems like if they got into a before flight situation and he didn't think the guy was fit to fly, then I feel like this person would say something or not fly. And so they're in the right space there. The other thing, you know, everybody has their train wreck night sometime, but it seems like he was just giving an example, but this is a repetitive behavior.
Sure.
Fortunately, I think on the bright side of things, the person that talked to him is the person that person in a position of leadership, especially at a small 135. And that was another captain, right? A peer. Yeah. So he's kind of doing what pro standards would do. Their peers are, they're kind of taking care of each other, letting the other guy know when he's out of line, and hopefully that cuts it off at the head. So
here's two things. I think you need to prepare yourself if you're on a trip with this person. I think you need to premeditate a couple of things. So number one, I think if I'm on a trip with a guy and let's say, we're going to be on a layover for 24 hours or whatever, I would preemptively tell him like, hey, love to go to dinner with you, but I'm not going to, I'm not having any cocktails. And, if you want to do that, that's on you. Like I'm out. I'm going to eliminate myself from that situation.
Or I don't drink on trips or whatever.
I don't drink on trips. Oh, I'm focusing on being really healthy this month. And, I'm doing some weight loss deal, whatever you want to say. But I think having a good excuse to remove yourself from that situation is really important. Number one, on a trip. And then number two, if it does feel like you show up at the airplane and you do have a reasonable suspicion that something's going on, I think you need to prepare have a game plan in place on how you're going to approach it.
Yeah. How you're going to intervene, essentially.
And how you're going to intervene.
Save your career and the captain's.
And his. And,
my first reaction to this, I'm like, they clearly said it's on a day off. Everyone was just hanging out.
Yeah.
I'm like, what are you going to do? Say the guy, you don't like what the guy does on his free time at home. That was my initial reaction. And then the more I thought about it, in the business that we're in, that behavior, while not at work, has a high likelihood of spilling over into work at some point.
And especially because I say like what he makes it sound like is this person is probably there's a struggle there. I think they even say it's a disease, right? The alcoholism.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah.
But I think the other thing is since the other captain that talked to him and made him apologize has already breached that subject, I think in this scenario, rather than going to the chief pilot or someone in a management position at the company, I think you still want to kind of handle it like a pro standard situation. And I would talk to the other captain that already counseled him and voice your concern as well and say, hey, what can I do? How can I support you or help? Mm-hmm. So we head this off before it puts us in a really bad spot at work in the future.
Yeah. And the ultimate goal is to get this person help. And it's one of those things like we've seen time and time again in this, the person's not going to get help until they arrive at that conclusion. So,
and that's the thing, but we're also making the assumption that the guy needs help. I mean, some people just party hard.
Yeah.
And necessarily aren't alcoholics and they just don't know sometimes the time and the place.
Yeah.
So I think before the other thing too, is you just want to be careful when you start to make assumptions and draw conclusions that you don't necessarily know verifiably that that's true.
And these types of situations are often interview questions at jobs, especially airlines. And I think the reason is because there's a lot of finesse and there's a lot of thought that's got to be put into how to handle that situation. So I'd love to hear some advice from some of our listeners that maybe have encountered this situation. I think especially at the smaller company level.
Yeah, I can say I've never been in that situation.
I haven't handled this situation.
So certainly are people out there that probably have better insight than we are, and we'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, absolutely. Instead of hearing how fast you play the podcast, let's hear how you handled this situation.
Because this is not a one-off situation. This has been asked in interviews. This has happened a lot of times. They've developed a program around this at all the year. I mean, this is a ongoing recurring problem that never has a very clear cut and definitive solution. So you kind of have to lay all the possibilities based on your situation, of which I'm sure we certainly haven't covered all of them. So
sure. Let us know. I think, you know, from a professional standpoint, I think the most important thing is making sure that the aircraft is operated safely and legally. And so making sure you have kind of rehearsed what you're going to do if those situations occur. I think that's one of the most important things you can do right now.
Yeah.
Let us know your input on that one. info@215podcast.com. Okay. Main event time, Max.
Let's talk about it. Let's get into the fractionals.
Let's go find out about the fractional world with Jim Dunn at FlexJet. We've got a very special guest joining us today. It is Jim Dunn. He's the director of training over at FlexJet, the fractional side of things.
The mysterious side of aviation that you and I, you know, we've been at the airlines, we've done the corporate stuff, we've done 135. Fractional is the box we have not checked. So I'm excited to talk to Jim and fill in the gaps of our knowledge.
Exactly. Welcome to the program, Jim.
Thank you guys very much. It's great to be here. Nice to meet you guys in person finally, and I'm looking forward to talking about the fractional industry with y'all.
Absolutely. Well, let's jump right into it. Can you explain for any of our listeners that don't really know what a fractional is? Can you explain what that model is?
Sure. Yeah. So fractional started many years ago with the quarter share model. So for people who fly corporate jets, there's a certain mission. When you get past a certain point, it doesn't make sense to own a whole jet. So they segmented the jets into quarter shares, and they sold off pieces or fractions of those jets. So you'll have a jet that's owned by several different owners, and then it's under a management contract, and internally it operates alone like an airline, but externally it's very corporate to flight type of aviation.
And one other thing that I think a lot of people, laymen especially, that don't understand is that you're not going to necessarily fly on the jet you own the quarter of all the time, or the fraction of, right?
That's correct. Yeah, there's an interchange agreement. So a lot of times, owners might not even see the tail number that they actually own in the program. So what the agreement does is allows them the opportunity to fly within the program, and the jets are used throughout the whole owner group.
You know, you're one of the fractionals, Jim, but is it safe to say that business is good in the entire fractional industry right now?
Business is booming in the entire fractional industry right now. We are flying more than we know what to do with, which is not a bad problem to have. It's pretty cool, actually.
Can you talk a little bit about the types of airplanes you guys operate?
Sure. So we actually operate 6 different fleets right now. We operate the Phenom 300. We operate the Legacy 400/Freighter 500, which is the new Embraer product. We operate the Challenger 300, 350. And then in our large cabin fleets, we operate the Global Express. We operate the Gulfstream G450 and the Gulfstream G650.
And why we're on this subject, so Flex was supposed to be the launch customer for the Ariane supersonic jet, right?
Yes, we were.
And then unfortunately, that was going to be really exciting. That was going to be super cool. And then unfortunately, that didn't work out over at Ariane. So what's the plan with that? Was there any sort of like fleet? Obviously, there's nothing that can directly
replace it. What's the plan, Jim? Are you going to do another
supersonic? Are you guys going to develop that internally now?
So we're putting some pieces together right now on a new airplane that we haven't really announced. No. So, getting an airplane off the ground and to production is a large capital investment. And, you know, we were one of the first investors in the Ariane, and we were very excited to include that into our international large capital program, was the plan. But the capital ran out before they could get it to manufacture. So if you follow us out there, we're also involved with the Gulfstream G7, which is going to be launched 2023. If you haven't followed that airplane out there, it's pretty amazing airplane, 18-hour legs on it, all fly-by-wire. The cockpit is very special. space age, looks like iPads in there. That's quite impressive. And we're the launch customer partner with Gulfstream on that. So that's our next evolution, moving into the fractional market. And we're really excited about that. And we're looking forward to that.
Wow. So how does it work, Jim, especially when you have a new fleet and you say, all right, we're going to buy 25 airplanes, let's say, or whatever number it is. Do you round up the owners first and then kind of figure out how many people want to buy a share and then place an order? Or do you do it the other way? Can you talk about that at all?
So that falls in the sales realm, but I'll give you my best shot at it. So it's based on sales projections on how we actually do our fleet planning. And so what we found this year, for example, you know, we were starting the year off with a delivery of 18 aircraft. We ended up finishing off the year with 25. And then looking into 2022, we're looking to 42 aircraft deliveries. So that's how much the business has expanded as a result of the pandemic and the world events right now. So like I said, business is booming and we're really excited about it.
That's great to hear. Let's talk a little bit about the being a pilot at a fractional. Can you walk us through the lifestyle? Maybe what's different than being a corporate pilot or an airline pilot? Why would people want to look at being a pilot at a fractional?
Sure, absolutely. So there's a couple of things you need to know about fractional flying that are givens about fractional flying. So you're going to have your schedule generally about 4 weeks prior to you flying it. And it's a fixed schedule that you actually bid. So once it's awarded to you, you can look out and see what days you're going to work and what days you're not. You know you're going to get a minimum of 10 hours of rest every night you fly out there. And there's some variables in there too. And your trips every week are going to be variables. So let's just start off with the airplanes. First of all, the airplanes are nomadic, okay? So different from the airlines, where the airlines have four or five bases and you bid on the different bases, we have 80 bases because we airline pilots to airplanes. It doesn't matter if we have one pilot in a base or 100 pilots in the base. So it makes it really easy for us to have 80 different domiciles out there. So that's the first thing you need to know about fractional flying. Those fixed items, you know what days you're going to work, you know what days you're going to have off, and those are every week is going to be different. So 23 years of doing this, and I still go on flying. There's still airports just in the United States alone that I never knew even existed. The missions that we do, everything from private ranch airports for high net worth owners to major large class B airports, and you might even do both of them in the same day. So it's very dynamic type of flying. On average, we'll do runways, we'll service runways anywhere between 4,000 and infinity of feet. So that gives us a wide range, about 5,000 airports alone just in the United States. And then you add that to an international convention. And it's quite a aviator's mission. It's a fun way to fly.
One of the things I've always said about, you know, I went from business aviation to the airlines, but I never would have gone to the airlines if I couldn't be based where I live. And that's only a luxury that some of us have in only a few cities in the country, right? For different airlines and so. So I've always like, this is a great option. If you don't live in a big airline base and you know, want that kind of structure, this is like a perfect alternative to be based at home and getting to and from work is not your problem or your worry, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely right. So, you know, having 80 domiciles, you've got a lot of choices of places that you can live. The great thing about the domicile system versus an airline. So an airline, let's say you bid for a particular fleet and seat and it gives you a certain city. So let's say it's Chicago and you're excited about going there. And then someone senior to you says, hey, you know what? I let that fleet and seat in Chicago. Guess them. So you're going to get bumped out and then you might be, you know, getting a crash pad, LaGuardia or wherever the case may be.
Jeez, Jim, are you trying to pull yourself in the wound here? I'm just kidding. I got displaced from Phoenix to Las Vegas. That's why I'm saying that. But
oh, there you go. There you go. So yeah, so you might get displaced.
Well, he's right. That can happen. Turns out.
So for us, it doesn't matter. So if I've got, take Dallas, for instance, is where I live. If we have 100 pilots here, one pilot, 1,000 pilots, it doesn't matter because we're going to airline you to the airplane.
That's interesting. I kind of forgot. I hadn't even thought about that really, that you can't really get displaced.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and a couple other cool things about our domicile system that I don't think a lot of people know, you know, so let's say you come into the business and you're living in, we'll use Phoenix since you guys are out there and you decide, you know what, my family and I, we'd really like to move to the East Coast. So Charlotte's an option. You basically give us 30 days notice and then you move to Charlotte and now you're based out of Charlotte. So, you know, it's really that simple. We also, our pilots will use our domicile system a lot for temporary gateway domiciles. So say you're doing a vacation with your family. And you live in Dallas and your family wants to go ahead. Let's use Orlando since I was just there. And you would tell our scheduling group, hey, on this, at the end of this tour, could you send me to Orlando? And they'll send you to Orlando. You go enjoy your time with your family. And if you want to, you can even have them dispatch you back out of Orlando. And at the end of the next tour, they'll get you back to your domicile. So a lot of flexibility in the domicile system that we have within the fractional industry.
I've also heard of pilots too that summer or winter in different locations, you could just change your domicile depending on the season. It's that easy, right?
Absolutely. I can think of one case that we have a pilot who has a home up in Chicago and one in Florida. So he spends the summer months up in Chicago and the winter months down in Florida. So it works out really well for him to do that.
Like you said, Max, it'd be perfect for you for being a big skier because you just follow the snow every year.
There you go.
it's not much of an option when you have kids in school and everything, but when they leave, that would be very nice.
Pretty slick. So Jim, tell us a little bit. You mentioned there's rotations, you bid for schedules. Can you tell us a little bit about what these different schedules look like? Is it just 7 on, 7 off?
There are some options for 7 on, 7 off. There are some options for 8 on, 7 off. Depends on which fractional. Mm-hmm. We happen to have a system, it's called PDS, which was actually used in the airlines. And we started with the airline version years ago. And that didn't quite work out for us because in the fractional industry, you're bidding for days on and you're bidding for days off. Whereas the airlines, you bid for trips or specific trip pairings. So there was features of PDS that were really good for us for efficiency. So we hired some really fancy engineers to come in here, very guys a lot smarter than I am. And they basically reverse engineered it. And we built an in-house program that designed it, the PDS system specifically for the fractionals. So it allows us the efficiency to have peak days where we can schedule more pilots on peak days and then let more pilots off on certain days. But to give you a general idea of what the schedules look like, a typical tour is anywhere between 4 and 8 days. And then you're going to have anywhere between 3 to infinity days off at the end, depending on how you bid. And so it's one big mathematical equation, basically, on how you do that. And then again, you know, each fractional is a little bit different. We have some other features within our fractional. So as you get some seniority within our organization, we have a group called the Red Label Pilots within our group. And the feature of being in the Red Label program is that you actually get to work with a team of 3 pilots and actually handwrite your schedules. So you have maximal flexibility in your schedules working in our Red Label program. So it's something to aspire to.
Wait,
so,
can you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah. I've never heard of this.
Absolutely.
Whoa.
Let's stop right there, Jim. Did you say you could write your own schedule?
Yes, you can.
All right. Go ahead.
So we have a couple of programs within FlexJet that's pretty exciting. So we've got the basic fractional program where we use PBS. And then we have what we call the domestic Red Label program, which we actually operate in our Challenger 300, 350 program and our Legacy 450, Praetor 500 program. And what we do in that program is we actually build teams of 3 captains in that program, and it's done by seniority. And they're actually have a dedicated tail number that they're assigned to and they're responsible for when they do this. So it's the tail number is assigned to them, to the most junior pilot of that group of a 3-man team. And that 3-man team works together, and they've got one rule, basically. And the one rule is that they cover the left seat of the aircraft 365 days a year with 1 day of overlap as they make the exchanges. So it gives them maximum flexibility to write their schedules. So they actually turn their schedules in. They work as a team and say, hey, okay, who's working Christmas this year? Well, last year I drew the short straw, so you get to do it this year. So vice versa. And then they'll actually write their schedules out. And so it's a really interesting concept. And to be honest with you, it was no one knew if it was really going to work. It's been very popular within our ranks here as the pilot group. And so about 65 to 70% of our pilots now are in the Red Label program. So they actually get to write their schedules.
That's so cool. So are they actually flying that same airplane all the time, right? Because they're all just rotating off of it.
Exactly. You're responsible for that tail number. So one of our peak tenants is fanatical attention to detail. And that really increases that fanatical attention to detail when that airplane belongs to you, you know, because now, let's say you have a window shade that has been NEL'd for a couple of days and you swap into that airplane. Well, it's going to get fixed within the NEL time, but you might push that maintenance controller a little bit to get it up and running because you have that pride in that airplane. So it's about focusing on the details and having the pride in it, that's a particular tail number. Plus, you all know the sounds and creaks and moans that the airplane makes. It's a familiar setting for you.
Yeah, that's really cool to fly the same piece of equipment because you get to know that airplane and follow along with what's going on. But what I have a question, what's the minimum? There's got to be a minimum length. Is it 4 days of minimum time during each rotation?
Yeah, minimum length is four days. And then maximum, we try and tap out at 8 days in our standard FlexJet program. 8 days is a long time to be on the road, you know, but a 4-day is about the minimum amount of efficiency we can get within our program. So we put a 4-day limit on the one end and an 8-day limit on the other end.
Wow, that's pretty cool. So can you trade between groups? Like if you're in a group and everybody wants the weekends off, then obviously that's not going to work great. But if you're in a group where somebody loves to work Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and the other guy loves, you know, or whatever, can you transition to find better fits?
Yeah, so that's the benefit of the Red Label program. So you don't necessarily want to hire your best, work with the best, your best friend here, because your best friend might have the different working idea than you do. What you want to do is find the best fit for your team. You know, someone who wants to work, you know, if you want to try and get weekends off, you want to find that person who's okay working the weekends. And you also, you know, if you want to work a lot of days, get paid more, you want to find someone who doesn't maybe want to work as much in between. So it's about finding that right mix. And we don't assign the pilots to those groups of three. You actually pick the guys and gals you're going to fly with. So it's a good synergy within that team.
That's Hunger really Games. Cool. I like that.
Yeah, it's exactly right. You know, last guy to get picked for the kickball team.
That's right. So let's get back to the non-red label. Domestic red label, I think, also sounds like a type of whiskey. I'm just going to throw that out there also.
Yeah, exactly.
But let's go back. You were mentioning PBS. So let's say I'm just a regular line pilot. I'm not a red label or anything like that. So I can go in and basically, from my understanding of PBS, let's say, oh, my kid's got a big soccer tournament one weekend, so I'm going to put that as a priority to get off. And I get his doctor's appointment in the middle of the week, a different time. I mean, it gives you some flexibility, so it's not as rigid, right?
That's absolutely correct. So what PBS does, it'll generate every mathematical possibility for schedule that you could bid on. And then there's filters bid into PBS. So you can do exactly what you said. You can bid for the days you want on, the days you want off, the number of days that you want to work, the number of days you want off in between, and every variable in between that. And then once you filter it down to a group of lines, then you rank those lines one through, you know, let's say there's 10 lines available that you want, one through 10 of how you'd want those lines, and that's your bid.
Oh, so there is a line.
Yeah, it's an actual line. So I don't know if either of you guys worked with PBS before, but the PBS for the airlines, you would assign point values to everything and you send this off in cyberspace. And then something would come back and it's like, okay, well, that's kind of what I bid for. What we did when I was telling you earlier that we actually hired some guys to rewrite the software, we did it so that we could actually see the train that's going to hit you first. So it actually generates the lines and then we can see the lines mathematically. And then now you can filter them down and then bid all those lines.
Now, once your line is assigned or you get awarded what your schedule is, there ability to trade or to manipulate it at all after that point?
Yeah, we work with our pilots quite often to, you know, if you've got something special going on, you know, a wedding or a birthday and you didn't get it in your bid, you know, but we try and work with them to help them, you know, get the lifestyle that they want. You know, can't guarantee everything, but we're really good. We'll work on our pilot group about that.
That's interesting.
That's cool.
And then let's say 1 month you don't want to work a lot and you kind of bid for a low time line or whatever. Do you generally base this by like your pay is based on the days of availability for the month? Is that kind of sort of how it works?
Yeah. So you get paid on a daily rate. And then so however many days you're assigned is what you're going to get paid for that month. So you could bid for as little as 14 days on per month or as many as 18 days. So you guys are pilots and this is all pilots listening on here. Pilots think about two things. They think about schedule and pay. And so when we're thinking about how we actually build our schedules and how we look at our pay scales, we try and give maximum flexibility to do both things, you know, so you make a really sustainable wage and you have a good quality of life at the same time. And, you know, and everyone's different, you know, and you're exactly right when you say that, Dylan. You know, some guys, you know, and they might have a month where they don't want to work a lot, but hey, Christmas is coming up. I really would like to work a little bit more and make a little extra money.
Wow. It's starting to sound like the best of both worlds, like you advertised. So, Jim, let's shift gears a little bit and talk about the process of becoming a pilot at a fractional. Let's use Flexjet because obviously that's where you have your specialty. Talk a little bit about what it's like right now in the recruiting and hiring landscape, and then we'll shift into being a new hire, training, all that kind of stuff.
Gotcha. So for 2021, our goal has been to hire 200 pilots this year. So we've actively been interviewing usually 2-3 times a week, and we're running indoc classes every 2 weeks. So looking into 2022, our goals have been assigned to us. We're looking for 300 pilots for 2022. So we got a lot of work cut up for us. A typical pilot profile is like every airline that you've ever experienced out there. You've got military pilots, you've got corporate pilots, you've got people who've done on-demand flying, come from the regionals. So it's a good mix of the pilot group that we look at. Average time for a pilot coming on here. So our advertised minimums are 2,500 with 500 multi, 500 turbine. We do make some exceptions with that, depending on what the resume looks. And so the typical process for a pilot to get hired on here, you start with applying at flexjet.com. And then it goes through a phone screen process. We look at your application. If you meet the qualifications, we take you through a phone screen process. And if we like you on the phone screen, we send you to Dallas where you do a panel interview and a simulator evaluation. And the panel interview, we call it a technical interview, but the panel interview, we're really just trying to get to know who you are. One interesting thing about the fractional industry that we really focus on, this is a customer service business. And so when you come in for the panel interview, we're trying to find out a little bit of your customer service skills, how you interact with people, you know, how are you going to be to be with for 8 days on the road? And that's, you know, just as important as being a good pilot. We'll find out your technical skills in the simulator. And the simulator evaluation we do is about a 20-minute evaluation where we look at the basic instrument flying skills, a CRM, and then make sure that you're going to be successful through our training program.
You know, one other thing, Jim. So I just did a quick Google of pilot pay for Flexjet. You know, I was just kind of curious. And it's interesting. The advertisement that you guys have right now is three things that, and one really caught my eye that's very different from anywhere else. So over 80 domiciles, we talked about that. First officer right. pay starting at about $100,000.
That's correct.
Yep. And the other one was guaranteed captain upgrade opportunities after 5 years. And it says in here, so right now it's forecast is 2 years, but as we know in aviation, a forecast is worth about what it's written on. But it says guaranteed captain upgrade at the completion of 5 years. How does that work?
Yeah, so that's exactly right. When you talk about the forecast, when guys come in for the interview process, we do a presentation for them and we talk about upgrade time. Upgrade time right now, just to give you an idea, is running about a year at the company on property. But that said, that's a moving target. And it's probably one of the hardest target for an aviation operation to predict because there's so many things that affect it. Aircraft deliveries affect it, attrition affects, economic events, world events, all those things can affect that number. So what we did and committed to is if you come on board here and you're expecting a year upgrade, and let's say all those things fall through for whatever reason, and hopefully they don't. What we've guaranteed is if you're going to stay with us and give us the longevity, we're going to upgrade you to captain at 5 years and put you onto the captain scale, even if there's not a captain position available for you. So you're going to be guaranteed that upgraded in salary at that time.
Wow. You can actually
make a plan.
You'll
never hear that at the airlines, ladies and gentlemen.
One other question here. As a candidate, let's say that I have a type rating in an airplane you guys already operate. Does that guarantee me, like if I'm already Phenom 300 type, that I'm going to get in that fleet? Or as a new hire, are you assigned based on seniority to the airplane? And can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So let me just talk about the typical pipeline for a pilot coming on board the company. So when we hire a pilot in the company, we hire you as a first officer into one of three aircraft types. We hire you into the Phenom 300, the Legacy 450, 500, or the Challenger 300, 350. Doesn't matter which one you go into, it all pays the same. The way we determine which airplane you're going to go into, that is basically the in-dock date that you come into and where we have the training slots and which fleet has the need at that time. So every in-dock class that I've had this year, it's been a little bit different mix of the group that's come in here. I've had all Challengers in the class. I've had all Phenoms. I've had combinations, Phenoms, Challengers, Legacies. It really just depends on what's happening within our deliveries, where we need pilots and ships with upgrades, et cetera. That said, your first upgrade opportunity is going to be into the left seat of the small cabin airplane, the Phenom. And so upgrade time right now is right at about a year within our company to the left seat of the Phenom. And then we take the philosophy, once a captain, always a captain. So your next bid is going to be to the captain of either the midsize, super midsize aircraft. And that's the either the Legacy or the Challenger 300, 350. We just had our first group that moved from when we started hiring quite a bit into the Challenger 350, and that was about 3.5 to 4 years that they'd been on property. So that's what we're expecting into the mid, super mid-sized cabin airplane right now. So that's the typical path that we do. And then we have another path for a pilot when you come on board into our large cabin airplanes. So I mentioned earlier, we're flying Gulfstreams and Globals. And so for a pilot to get into that program, that's also what we call our International Large Cabin, a red label program. And the way we do that is we actually will take and we put five pilots on each one of those airplanes. And it's an interview process to get into those airplanes. So what we do is we put out two opportunities to apply for the position. You can either apply for a commander on the aircraft or a pilot on the aircraft or both. And then if you apply for a commander, you'll interview for commander. And if you get selected for commander, they give you the list of all the other pilots that applied that's on our seniority list. And then you build the team of the other four pilots on there. And then once you have your five pilots, they're all captain qualified on those airplanes, kind of like a small corporate flight department, and they're responsible for covering that airplane. So it's a separate path that a pilot can take when they come on board here. So for a new hire, it is maybe not probable, but it's possible to get into a large cabin airplane once you come on property as a pilot here, because you can apply day one into that program if you want to. And a lot of people think it's a really senior program for pilots to go in there. Not necessarily the case, because it goes back to that team concept that we're talking about. You want to have a team of people that you can work with. So we actually have some international large cabin airplanes where we've had people on property for right at 2 years within the company.
Wow. So if you're a new hire, but you had extensive international experience, maybe some other things that it might.
Absolutely.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah.
So, we look at all sorts of different things that's going to make a great team, whether it's international experience, you might speak four languages, you might be an AMP, so all those things are helpful when you're talking about a program of that magnitude.
We did an episode a few weeks ago, Max, talking about AQP and some of the advantages that the airlines have. Jim, do you guys take advantage of any of those types of training programs in your operation?
Yeah, so I listened to your that podcast last week. It was a great podcast, by the way. And it was mentioned in there that Flexjet was AQP. That was actually not correct. We're not AQP, but we're a standard 135 training program that is very much structured like an airline. So this is something that a lot of people don't understand about the fractional aviation market. Internally, we operate a lot like a 121 airline. And what I mean by that is we have a lot of the same safety programs. We have an ASAP program. We have a flight data monitoring program. We have a lot of the same processes with OEs that you would have at a 121 airline. We have a large dispatch center that takes care of the pilots out there. So we have schedulers, planners, maintenance personnel, logistics folks, all working in the same room to take care of the pilots. The objective is, just like a 121 airline is, we want the pilots to go out there and focus on two things. Safety being the number one thing, and then taking care of the customers. So we try and take care of all the other stuff in the background. So that's filing your flight plans, making sure that all your travel arrangements are made, your hotels are done at the end of the night, you've got your airlines at the front and the back end of your tours. Everything is taken care of for you as a pilot here. So it's very turnkey working here. Our training program, since we've done, was the specific question that you asked about. It's a standard 135 training program. We come back to recurrent twice a year. We do a long recurrent event. We do a short recurrent event. And the initial event is somewhere between 3 and 4 weeks, depending on the aircraft that you go into, which is a 6-day in-doc plus the aircraft training. We usually send you home for 7 days after you complete the aircraft training. And then we schedule you for an OE event, which is broken into two. There's a primary OE, which is basically an extended pre-flight, the first time you fly the airplane empty, so that you kind of put all the theory that you got in the simulator world together with the airplane. And then you fly 25 hours with a check pilot or instructor pilot out on the line until you get signed off and comfortable with the airplane. And then we kick you out of the system from there.
Walk us through a typical tour for a line pilot. What does that look like? What's your average day look like?
Sure. Absolutely. So it'll actually start on your last day off. You're going to be, we provide you a phone and an iPad, and on your phone, you're going to have some proprietary software where we basically run all of our trips through. So you're going to open up that software. And the first thing you're probably going to see is a travel block on your first day on. So as I mentioned earlier, we move pilots to airplanes, not airplanes to pilots. So it's usually going to start off with an airline block. So let's start in Dallas. So let's say you're catching American Airlines flight 1234. And it'll tell you you're flying with Captain Smith and you're going to Fort Lauderdale at 7 o'clock in the morning on that flight, where you'll pick up 593FX. And when you guys get to 593FX, you're going to position over to Naples. You're going to pick up four passengers, and then you're going to fly those four passengers to Atlanta Fulton County Airport. And you're done at the end of the day. So when you finish at the end of the day, you'll open up that phone application again and you'll look at it and you'll have your hotel information built in there. You'll have your rest block for the night built in there, and you'll have your on-duty time and your proposed trips for the next day. So let's say your proposed trips out of Fulton County, you're coming on duty at 8 o'clock in the morning, departing at 9 o'clock. You're going to go Fulton County to Kansas City downtown, live from Kansas City downtown with 6 to Telluride, Colorado. And then you're going to position from Telluride to Eagle, Colorado, live from Eagle to Portland, Oregon. Pretty long day. So, and we do work some pretty long days sometimes. And so you'll do all those trips. You get to Portland, you do the same thing. And you'll do this for 4 or 5 days. And then till you get to your last day. So their last day, we got to get you home. So your next to your last day, your trip's going to be built a little bit different. The way it's going to be built basically is, for your last day, it's going to show you probably flying a trip in the morning and then a travel block to get you home in the afternoon. So let's say you ended your second to last day in Santa Ana, California, Orange County. And your trip out of there is Orange County live with 3 passengers to Denver Centennial. And then when you get to Denver Centennial, you have an airline out of Denver, American Airlines 4567, departing Denver at 4 o'clock. That gets you to Dallas at 7:30. And so now you got to figure out how you're going to get from Denver Centennial over to Denver International. You catch your airline, you go home, you turn your phone off, you enjoy your time off with your family, and you come back and do it again the next week. And it's going to look totally different as far as your trips are concerned. So the fixed things that you're going to have is you're going to know your days on. You know your days off. You're going to travel on your first day. You're going to travel on your last day. You're going to get a minimum of 10 hours of rest every night, sometimes more, uninterrupted. And then every week, your trips are going to look different.
That was a great explanation, Jim, except for one question I have.
Yeah,
how do you get from, what's the ground transportation situation? Do you get a car? How does that work?
Yeah, so this is an exercise in plane strains and automobiles, which is actually part of the fun of the job sometimes. So we use Uber a lot. Sometimes we use sedan services. Sometimes we use taxis. And even in some cities, we've been known to use the trains and the buses at times. And depending on where your trip ends, if you end up in the Caribbean somewhere, you might actually get a water taxi to your hotel tonight. So there's been lots of stories about that over the years. So, you know, so we definitely utilize the transportation system. The one thing I didn't add in there is we'll rent a car every once in a while, too.
So on a normal overnight, though, you're typically using like Uber or the hotel van to get to your accommodations?
Most time, if everything works out the same. But then you're going to find yourself in Mule Shoes, Texas, where, you know, you got Stan's taxi cab service. And that's who you're working with to get you to the hotel that night.
Right. I'll tell you, for listeners that don't have a lot of contacts, maybe flight instructors and stuff, that might sound a little overwhelming. I'll tell you, flying 135 is so much fun because you never know what's coming up next. And the variety is what I loved about that so much, because you are going to go and see places of the country that you have never even heard of or imagined. And that was my favorite part about flying 135.
Yeah. What I used to tell people about that kind of flying was that you would go to places that in the normal course of your life, you will never go to. Like the airlines, it's all relatively bigger cities and this and that, that you might find yourself. But I mean, I remember where I went to the sock capital of the world, like before it all moved to China, was this town in Alabama. And they like were known for textile production of socks. And it was like, it was the craziest trip. We had so much fun in this place. I would never, ever have gone there.
Yeah, and that's what it's like every week. You know, we do frequent a lot of the same places because a lot of our clientele, you know, like to go to a lot of the same places. And the great thing about our clientele is they usually like to go to nice places. So, you know, we do a lot of the mountain airports. So we're getting ready to get very busy in the mountain airports. Eagle, Aspen, Telluride, Jackson Hole, you know, the Caribbean's very busy for us. And then, you know, we're also international too, which I really haven't mentioned a lot of. But, I mean, we do Mexico a lot. We do Canada. And we do world trips in our large cabin airplanes. I mean, we have airplanes all over the world at any given time.
All right, Jim, I've been waiting to bring this up. I know this is going to be a sensitive subject, but we need to broach this crew meal situation.
The crew meal situation. Yeah. So as I like to say, when you come to work here, you're going to gain the FlexJet 15. We actually have two meal programs working in FlexJet. So one thing I tell candidates when they come in and we're giving the presentation, you are not going to starve working here. So we automatically order you breakfast and lunch if you're flying over breakfast and lunch, and you get to order what you want. We have a basic menu out there that you could choose from, but you know, you can customize that a little bit. We can never guarantee 100% you're going to get exactly what you want. Depends on how quick we get your order, what kitchen it's coming from, and what you order. But we're pretty good about getting people what they want. And if you're flying over the dinner hours, you let our catering group know. They'll have a meal on board the airplane. Flying over backside of the clock, if you want a snack flying, you let our catering group know, and they put it on there. And these are, you know, this is high-end catering. It's really, really nice food. It's not, you know, stuff you get out of, you know, a Subway or stuff, somewhere like that. And so that's our normal crew meal program. But we actually have a different one as well within our organization. Our pilots are allowed to actually purchase a meal on the company every night with no limit on what the cost of that meal is.
Oh, no. Did you actually said that?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of rope.
We're recording you, Jim. Do you know this?
I do know you're saying that.
These are pilots, right? You understand
exactly
that.
Exactly. So let me explain that a little bit more. So we have a philosophy here, management by trust. Matter of fact, our principal and owner, Ken Rickey, actually wrote a book, Management by Trust. It talks about his life as a corporate pilot. And everyone out here is pilots. You know what it's like. You'll have one of those days where, you know, maintenance is a problem, or you're delayed, or you got cranky owners, or whatever the case is. It just makes it a really long day. And having that ability to go and purchase a meal and get a good night's rest kind of resets everything, that you come back out the next day and you're ready to go do it again. So from his experience as a corporate pilot, he allows us to do that. And the philosophy behind it is managed by trust. There's no costs on the meal. We trust our pilots with a multi-million-dollar asset, with multi-million, sometimes billion-dollar net worth individuals and their families, with a mission to go all over the world. The thought is we can trust you to buy dinner too. And so, you know, I will tell you, on an average night, a pilot spends between $30 and $35. We, you know, most guys and ladies out there eat like they normally would eat. But you're going to find yourself in a place or one of those days where a steak really just sounds good. Go get the steak. It's okay. It's not a problem. If that's what it takes to reset you and make you eat better the next day, you know, so be it.
I would be at the FlexJet 30, I think. This could be a big problem.
Yeah, trust me, you will not starve if you come to work here. That is not a problem we have at all. I mean, it really is a great system. It makes it a great way to work, you know, and especially the catering system. It's all taken care of for us. You know, it shows up at the FBO. You pick it up, you put it on the airplane. The line crews love us because we usually have a plethora of food on board the airplane. So they're usually going to eat pretty good that night when we pull into the chocks.
You were talking about tough days with maintenance and other things. I remember working more on the retail 135 side. The passengers were a big wild card because a lot of times, you know, in retail charter, you really don't know what you're going to get. A lot of people are first timers. They don't know what to do. Have you noticed a difference between retail 135 passengers and fractional passengers?
Yeah, absolutely. So the fractional passengers are more of a sophisticated flyer. And, you know, if you do this long enough, you actually start to establish some of the relationships with the owners. They're very savvy in aviation. They know a lot about business aviation and corporate jets and are very in tune to what's happening in the market. You know, they come to the fractional side of the business for the reliability and the safety aspects of it. And it's a great clientele base. You know, I can't say enough great things about the owners I've had the opportunity to fly in my career.
So it's not the kid turn the kids loose in the cabin and ground up cookies in the carpet all the time.
you might see that. I mean, being honest, you might see that every once in a while. But then, you know, you'll also have the passengers who will get off the airplane and you'll look back in the back and the belts are all crossed and it's all cleaned up and the trash is put away. So it's a great way. It's a customer service business. It's about taking care of people, and the people that we get to take care of are fantastic.
So, Jim, let's talk a little bit about some of the similarities between a fractional and the airlines. You know, maybe there's some airline folks that are looking to make the jump. And Max and I always kind of recommend for airline folks, hey, this is a good introduction to business aviation because there are some similarities. Do you guys have unions? Do you have contracts? What things might airline pilots find that are similar?
So a couple of things that I think are similar in the airline world and the fractional world. So the first thing is schedules. They're fixed schedules. So you're going to know what days you're going to go to work and what days you're going to come home. So that's a big piece. You have a lot of the same safety programs that are built into the company. So ASAP programs, flight data monitoring are within the organization. We go through several different audits on a regular basis. Plus, we're managed by a certificate management unit with the FAA. So they're very involved in our organization. The maintenance is top notch in the fractional industry. We have a superior maintenance. Flexjet alone has had over 21 diamond awards with the FAA. And we go through quite a few audits with that. You will not find better maintenance in the industry. In some of the fractional airlines, you will find unions and some of them you won't. Flexjet is a non-union shop. And it's, you know, I've worked in both a union shop and a non-union shop. That's one of the things I really like about working at Flexjet. We have a direct line to management and it works really well.
So no union per se, but there's like a contract or a pay scale. I mean, there are some things that are set in place, right?
That is correct. Yeah. So we do have a published pay scale. When you come on board property, you're given the pay scale in our pilot supplement. So you can project out what you're going to see, you know, for the life of your career within the company. Plus the benefits are very good, comparable to an airline. We've got great medical insurance. We've got loss of license. We've got disability. We've got both short and long term. We've got 401k, 100% match up to 6%. So a nice retirement as well. So you've got not only a good cafeteria plan for benefits, but you've got a good working lifestyle, a fixed schedule that you can count on, and great safety and good maintenance within the organization, very similar to an airline.
Sounds like an easy transition. Do you see any retired folks, you know, they're required to retire at the 121, you know, at 65? Do folks come over to you after retirement to continue flying? Are you seeing that?
We do have a few people that come over to continue their career within the organization, and it's always a good addition to the mix as well. You know, they bring a lot of good experience to the group, and you know, we've got to meet some just great people who've had stellar careers in the airlines, have come over here and made a stellar career here as well.
And then what about some of the similarities or as you compare it to corporate flying as we know it?
Yeah, so the best way to think of a fractional operation is it's 121 internally and very corporate on the external part of it. So as the pilots, you're the face of the company. You're taking care of the passengers. You're making sure that all their needs are met. So when we look for pilots, we're looking for pilots that want to get on board the airplane. They want to turn right first and take care of the owners. And then we want them to turn left, go in the cockpit, and then fly a safe airplane. And as I tell a lot of the candidates when they come through, I'd love to say every day is going to be perfect, but the reality is things fall through the cracks daily. And so you need people who want to be mission-driven, who can go out there and pick up the ball and solve the problems. And what that means is basically, we work with a lot of vendors, for instance, so car services, caterers, FBOs, and, you know, catering my fault, it's cracks. And you can, that owner is expecting, you know, a fruit tray on the airplane. So you have to kind of think outside the box and figure out how you're going to solve that problem and get that done. Make sure it's an exceptional experience. We may have ordered a sedan for them, and somewhere that order got lost. So guess what? If the sedan's not there and you can't get that a sedan or other transportation booked for them, you might be getting the crew car to make sure that they get to their meeting on time. And so it's about taking that door-to-door experience for the owner. For the second that the sedan rolls up to the airplane, you open the door, they're in your charge until you close the sedan, and they're on their way to their final destination.
It's interesting. So a lot of people ask me, oh, you know, why did you go to the airlines and leave corporate aviation or whatever? And I said, you know, there are things about both that I really, really like. And if I could combine, take those things and combine them, you would have pretty close to the perfect flying job. And it's interesting because the more I learn about this, the more the overlap, it kind of gets into there. Now, of course, there's still advantages to corporate, certain things and to airlines versus the fractional, but certainly is the closest thing that there is to meeting in the middle. It's really interesting. And it's going to be interesting, I think, too, to see where it goes over the next couple of years, because we're certainly in a pilot crunch. 2022 is going to be very interesting with that. And I think that everybody's going to have to, company-wide, you know, from the company standpoint, is going to have to put their best foot forward to get the most well-qualified candidates, which is going to be interesting to see how that changes from the top airlines down to the one airplane corporate operator and everything in between.
Absolutely. You know, I can also tell you in our recruiting process, you know, one of the things we say, and we're very direct and open when we bring candidates in and give them the presentation. This job is not for every pilot. You know, there's a lot of great pilots out there, but not everyone aspires to do this type of flying and the customer service aspect of it. So we tell candidates they're interviewing us as much as we're interviewing them, because we want them to come here and know what they're getting into when they come here. And you do have that, you know, that personal touch that you have to deliver to the owners. And so, and a lot of people don't want to do that. They just want to go out, fly their trips, you know, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. So that's kind of what we look for at candidates when we bring them on board. And you're absolutely right. It's going to be an interesting year, 2022, trying to find pilots throughout the industry.
Well, the other thing too, you mentioned, so kind of like somebody that wants just to come and fly their trip and go home and not really interact with the passengers very much and stuff, that would be a good airline fit. And then I think on the corporate side, there's a lot of guys, and I would kind of put myself in this category, that I didn't mind the customer service aspect and interacting with the passengers. I kind of liked that part, but it's all the other stuff that was always your problem on top of taking care of the passengers. So, you know, finding the hotel and the transportation for yourself and this and that and everything and for things for the passengers and this and the fractional business takes a lot of that noise and it becomes somebody else's problem. That's my favorite saying sometimes is like, you know what that sounds like? Not my problem. And so when everything is your problem, you really start to embrace the support that's the background support of people that can do some of that stuff, because you know what it's like to have to juggle it all. And sometimes it gets overwhelming when things don't go wrong or don't go right. And so I think that the people that have managed a flight department and things like that could really learn to embrace not having to deal with that and also probably improve their customer service skills, because you have more energy to devote to that versus spread so thin amongst everything else.
Absolutely. That's a very true statement. You know, we have so FlexJet as a whole is about 1500 employees, not just pilots. Of the pilots, it's about 875. And so that's a pretty large support staff that's taking care of the pilots in the background. That's it. Ordering your catering. That's making sure you get fit each day. Make sure that the transportation is set up for the passengers. Make sure that you have hotels at the end of the night, that your airlines are booked for you. All the things that like you mentioned, Max, that, you know, are the burdensome things of being a corporate pilot. And so, you know, the focus when we start out in the fractional market is to make it as turnkey as possible for the pilots to have that dedicated focus. And that's safe operation of aircraft and taking care of those passengers.
Yeah, that's,
you know, one other thing tacking on to what we're talking about, there were some of the differences too. Like I'm in a Part 91 operation where our trips are very different, right? I go out one leg, we're going to sit for two or three nights, and then we're going to come back. And that's great. And it's a completely different thing. But I had to go out and what I say, like, get reps before I could get to a job like that. And this is where I try and steer younger pilots that want to be in business aviation. A fractional is a good place to go because, yeah, flying a cushy 91 job where you're only going to fly maybe 100 hours a year might be good later on in your career when you got young children. But you have to build that foundation, I think, either a fractional or a regional where you're out there every day flying. You're going to fly maybe, I don't know, can a pilot fly 600-700 hours a year at FlexJet? Yeah,
absolutely. So the average pilot's going to fly about 700 hours a year. You hit the nail on the head with that, Dylan. And something different from corporate flying that you mentioned there, where you'll go sit for 2 or 3 days. We're going to sit maybe on a good day, we might sit 2 or 3 hours place. We usually have an hour on the ground. We turn right back around and we're out flying. We're very efficient about how we schedule our airplanes, our crews. So, and back to when every week is different, you know, every day is different too. You might have a day where you fly one leg, one long transcon, or you might be up in the Northeast and you do 5 legs that day. And every week's going to be different just depending on where you are and how the deck gets shuffled. So you're going to build a great experience, you know, pilots that come on board here. Not only it's the best of both worlds, you're going to find a good a career opportunity that you can make a good long-term career opportunity. And you're also going to get a lot of great experience in doing it.
Well, it was really interesting because our friend who lives in Phoenix that's on the Legacy, he was telling me about a little bit about how you guys were doing the shuttle stuff and how that was all working when they were staying off the airlines. That was really impressive, just how the logistics behind that were crazy.
Yeah, we actually built our own hub and spoke airline using Phenoms, and we had Dallas was the hub, and we had 11 spokes where we would move crews back and forth. And it was great at the initial part of the pandemic. It started to wear a little thin towards the end. But it really served a great purpose, and it kept, you know, we did some pretty innovative things at the beginning part of the pandemic and kept everyone employed and working, and we came out of it busier than we ever have been. It's been fantastic.
Yeah, that was really cool.
All right, Jim. Well, I think you've answered all of our questions. That was really interesting. And now, of course, like we do with all of our guests at the end, we're going to put you on the spot for a good story. Funny, interesting, whatever you got.
Wow. Okay. So, you know, doing this job, just like anybody that's been doing it a while, I've got lots of flying stories, you know, but related to fractional and just the company in general. So Hurricane Irma 2017. And if you remember that, there was a big evacuation order in Florida to get people out. And what we did for our owners was awesome. And I got to be a part of that. So we basically took a Challenger 300, 350, and I was one of the pilots on there. And we actually went down to Florida. We ran shuttles out of Florida from Florida to outside the hurricane zone multiple times as long as we could to get our owners and their families and some of their friends out of the Florida area. And so, you know, not necessarily a funny story, but a great story. And it's a great tribute to the company I work for because it's about taking care of people, not only internally and externally. And that included, you know, some family from our pilots as well. So it was quite an interesting experience. It was because as people started to move north, I remember we landed in Miami and it was like the apocalypse that hit Miami because nothing was moving on Miami airport, which was, you know, unheard of to ever see that. And it was quite a surreal experience, but at the end of it, it was a very rewarding and just a great experience for me. And again, a tribute to FlexJet and the people I work with.
You know, that's interesting, Jim, that you bring that up because I was doing the same thing during that same hurricane. And I remember that because I think I went to Fort Lauderdale. We picked up the company that I worked for at the time. One of our biggest customers, like, just needed to be bailed out. Like it was he had waited too long and his family and the airlines had already bugged out. And we were one of the last ones. I think Fort Lauderdale had just, it was middle of the day, but they're like, yeah, we're signing off. And the tower left. Exactly. And it was just, and it was, yeah, you're right. It was like the pod. There was nothing around. You're at this huge, I was at the big Fort Lauderdale airport and there was nothing going on.
Oh yeah.
Like it nothing. It was crazy. Like nobody even on the frequency. It was unbelievable. And I think the Tracon left too. And so
they did. Yeah. They did eventually leave.
He just like, we just blasted off and like, yeah. And we were at the very end. Like we barely were able to get fuel and blast it out of there. But that's funny. I forgot about that till you just brought that up. I think that was in the G3. That was back because you said it was 17, right?
But 2017 Hurricane Irma. So it was crazy. Yeah, I remember the last part of that, our last trip was back to Orlando, which was just north of the storm. So we were going to do one more trip out the next morning. And I remember descending into Orlando and everyone was moving north of Florida and it just looked like this line of ants. It was crazy. So, but yeah, so this is one of those stories that sticks out in my flying career, you know, amongst many of them. You know, this job, though, has afforded me several different opportunities. You know, I've gotten to fly major league pitchers, multiple major league pitchers, a guy going for his 300th win. That was an exciting experience. You know, you never know who's going to be in the back of the airplane. I've taken average guys that you meet, and you take them to Washington, D.C., you check into the hotel, you turn on the TV, and you find out that he's a, you know, CEO of a major defense company, and he just signed this multi-billion dollar deal, and you just took him in there. So it's just a great experience working for Fractional, because you just don't know who's going to get on your airplane, who you're going to see, and where you're going to go. And it just makes it a fantastic job.
Good stuff. Well, Jim, that was awesome. Thank you for all the info and enlightening us into the fractional side of aviation from a pilot's perspective.
Jim, if folks want to get more information about Flexjet, maybe look at applying and seeing what you're offering new hires, where's the best place for them to go?
So go to flexjet.com and the hiring tab. That's the first place to go to put your application in. And then, of course, you could follow us on all the major social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn. Please log on there. And there's always information out there as well. And then if anyone has a specific question, they're free to contact me directly through my email. And that's james.dunn@flexjet.com.
Mention offer code 215 podcast for a free crew meal.
Right. Yeah, there you go.
Awesome, Jim. Well, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it. And good luck out there.
Great. Thank you guys very much. It's been great to be on the show with you guys.
Let it slide up off the ground. We in ground effect, baby. We in ground effect. Just riding that thing. So feel, baby.
All right, so I walked away from that interview. We actually had a 30-minute conversation after we talked to Jim.
Yeah.
Just kind of digesting everything he said, and we were stupid. We didn't record it, unfortunately.
Professional podcasters.
Typical. Yeah.
We're very professional.
And we're like, wow, because it was just, you know, you and I just had a lot of thoughts. But a couple that came to mind there. Number one, we've always said, when you get out of school, out of flight training, hopefully you don't have a lot of personal attachments, and you have a lot of flexibility to be able to go and basically grind for a couple
years.
Grind
it out. You got to grind it out.
You got to go much get those reps
and a variety of experience and fly.
Yep.
You have to fly a lot of hours per year.
Yep. You got to get those reps, you know, 800, 600, you know, whatever you can get those first few years. Some people just don't want to do the regional airlines. And I think this is an awesome alternative to the regional airlines.
Now,
and
here's, I don't think it was really.
Yeah. And they're hiring with a lot lower experience. Yeah.
The time requirements. And, and you kind of leave with something, I guess, I hesitate to say like more valuable, but you have a type rating that's more valuable. Let's just say that.
You're diversified.
Yeah. Well, just one of the tools that you keep in your back pocket that we always talk about that you never know you're going to need in aviation. And so you leave with a business jet or multiple, because they operate so many different types that are usually very popular outside of the fractional world. So you leave with those type ratings, which I think was huge. And you also have that experience in the business aviation side of things, but you also understand some things from the airline side of things. So it really sets you up with a diverse and broad,
a really good foundation
and you get a taste really of both
in a way. I mean, you're like we led the show with talking about call outs and standardization. You get a lot of that you would get at the airlines too. So I think this is a real viable option for folks. I think it really diverts. Even if you say, you know what, I'm going to fly for Southwest Airlines, that's my ultimate goal, you go work at the fractionals for a while. Maybe you'll love it and you'll stick with it. But either way, man, now you have all that experience in business aviation and a type rating. And then, man, if a furlough or, you know, anything were to happen, you now
have.
The
other thing, too, that we see a lot in business aviation and people that haven't been in
Uh-oh. I didn't mean that.
Remember the graphic of that with like the flute peering out of the grass?
Yeah, Amos's wife drew that. It was incredible.
I forgot about that. That's so good. Yeah. Anyway, what I was going to say is so many people in business aviation, they get up kind of like against the fence where they have this time, they've been doing it for a while, and they're like, I really like this type of flying and I really like this, but I feel like I have to go to the airlines because of the retirement and the loss of license and the benefits and the schedule and this and that. But I really don't want to do that. I just don't want to walk around in big airports and just do that all the time. And I think that the fractionals, which is, like we said, kind of splits the difference very well, is oftentimes overlooked as a final destination that provides some stability and some of those other benefits that you don't traditionally see, and regularity with schedule, with bidding a schedule and knowing when your day's off, and all of those other issues that we contend with in business aviation. I just feel like the fractionals are oftentimes overlooked. And I think when people get there, we have a friend that has evaluated, very analytical guy, and has evaluated all the airlines and this and that and the retirement numbers and blah, blah, blah. And his decision was to stay at NetJets and make his career out of it, which I don't know that was his intent upon getting hired there. But
well, I think here's one major factor. And, you know, we get so many emails about commuting, right? And we get, like, we got the email from, I think even in the last episode, the guy that lived in, was it Tampa or some, it was a secondary city. And let's say that you live in a secondary city. You live in Spokane, Washington, or you live in, you know, Omaha, Nebraska, and you're not leaving for, you know, whatever the reasons are. I think that, especially when you're living in those secondary cities that are never going to be a major airline base, that I think is one of the great situations where fractional really makes sense, because then you're not commuting and you're not worried about, oh, I'm in a small base, it might close, it might not, you know, it doesn't matter.
Right.
You're there. So yeah, I think that's
one of the vehement anti-commuter.
Yeah.
Who's currently being forced to commute due to displacement.
But you're commuting under protest, I think. Does that matter?
Yeah, well, no, I don't think it does. But I will, you know, there's light at the end of the tunnel. And I've always said, do not sentence yourself to a life of commuting. Like, at least have an open mind of moving to a base, ultimately. Mm-hmm. But if you were just like, listen, I am going to live in Mobile, Alabama, and that's where I'm from, I'm never leaving there.
This disclaimer, we don't actually know if Mobile's a base for fractionals, but do your own research.
Yeah, as a gateway base, they call it. But yeah, that's just, I don't know why that popped in my head, but you know what I'm saying? At least then that's your base. Or if you split your time between two places, you're like,
yeah,
you
we can, talked about that. Yeah.
You heard that 30 days notice, boom, you're based somewhere else. No vacancy bids, no like nothing. You just, here I am. I airline out of here now. Thank you. Pretty good deal.
I'm glad Jim reached out to us and we were able to chat a little bit about that. Love to hear from some fractional pilots. Here's the one thing that I'll say, you know, and we touched on this in the interview. You're going to work hard at a fractional. There's no question. Like, when you're there, you're working.
Like an airline.
Like an airline. Yep. So don't think that it's, you know, you're just punching a clock and sitting in the FBO lounge and working on the weight machine. But
yeah, but there are benefits to that.
Yeah, absolutely. Idle hands, etc. Okay, I think that should do it. Anything else you want to add? Any last words from the dark side? Do you see? Are you secretly ready to punch back to business aviation, Max? Come back.
No. Well, listen. I came back at a tough time in that this is November. I'm in training. Then I get scheduled for OE at the end of November, which happens to be over Thanksgiving kind of time. And it's just, it's a tough time. But like I said, I've always said the key to being a successful airline pilot is having a good attitude and realizing and not getting caught up in the things you have no control over. Like when I get scheduled for OE and other things. So you just say, hey, you make the best of it. You make the best of it.
All you can control is your attitude.
You control your attitude and try and stay positive and move out smartly, because that's literally your only choice. So you may as well make the best of it. So that's what I'm doing. But I'll tell you what's interesting is you come back and we don't have a lot of like close friends and stuff that were in the military. So like a bunch of cool people here, we're hanging out and I was talking to one of them and he used to fly the B-2 and we were kind of talking about some of that. And he's like, you know, flying the B-2 is like really awesome and really terrible at the same time. I'm like, well, what do you mean? He's like, it's awesome. You're in this $2 billion, you know, machine that can do crazy stuff and it looks like no other airplane and this and that. He goes, but it's like this little cockpit. And sometimes we go on missions for like 24 hours. I'm like, is there like a crew rest area and stuff? He's like, no. I'm like, well, how many pilots are there? He's like, just two. I'm like, are you serious? Like, and they have to tank, like, you know, multiple times and hit the tanker and do all this. And I'm like, dude, that is intense. I'm like, what's the lab situation like? Like, it's just like a honeypot. Like, you got to carry out at the end. I mean, it's, and I'm like, do you guys like train for that? And listen to this. This blew my mind. They have to go and they do a 24-hour simulator session. They lock them in the simulator for 24 hours and they go fly a mission. Like, they have the lab in there, in the sim, the whole thing. I'm like, are you kidding way. Me? I'm done at, you know, hour and a half to 2 hours for that. I'm jonesing for that break. Could you imagine? 24 hours.
24 hours. And then, off you go,
listen
boys.
Listen to this. Then they wanted to see what the, like, the limit of human endurance, like how long someone could actually do this. And somebody volunteered and they put him in a simulator and they flew in the simulator, did like mission stuff before the guy finally tapped out and was like, I can't do it anymore. It was 44 hours.
That's still less than Ken Minus's 48 hours or whatever.
But that's the airplane, not the pilots.
I know, I know.
God.
That's insane.
Do you believe that? Man. I just got out of a 44-hour sim session.
Yeah.
I'm like, what? Like, we have to have a cooler back there? I mean, what? I don't know. And I started Googling it. They've done 33-hour missions where they take off from, like, Missouri and go all the
way. How do you maintain the mental acuity through that?
Well, they have, like, supplements that you can take to help, like, help with that. Because there's no way. There's no way. Like, how do you sit? I've stayed up for over 24 hours before, but that's, like, doing stuff. Not right. sitting in it. You know me. I sit down for too long. It's lights out. It's unbelievable. That just blew my mind. So, anyway, you never know what you're going to learn when you're back in training. I think we'll leave it at that.
Well, enjoy the rest of training. Enjoy the turkey and mashed potatoes in the crew lounge.
Hotel. Thank you.
I'm working over Thanksgiving, too, so it's just the way of things.
It's part of the game, baby.
That's going to be in the episode of the spouses and, you know, lifestyle. We'll cover all of that. So, all right, until next time, folks, remember.
Flexibility is the key to our power.
Especially over the holidays.
Respect.
See ya.
Blackguard.
The statements made in this show are our own opinions and do not reflect, nor were they under any direction from any of our employers.